Hi, it's Robin Young. Thank you for listening to Here and Now. If you love to listen to your favorite shows, hear your favorite stories, and NPR is your personal connection to the world, keep your love for public radio alive. Visit donate.npr.org/now to give, and then tell the world why you're passionate about listening by tweeting or posting on Facebook with hashtag WhyPublicRadio.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, and today for Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Congressional Republicans are on the verge of passing the most sweeping overhaul of the tax code in decades. The $1.5 trillion bill would slash the corporate tax rate and give Republicans a major legislative victory in a year marked by setbacks. We're waiting on the House to pass the bill again after changes were made. President Trump is expected to sign the bill into law this afternoon at the White House. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said Republicans will rue the day they pass this bill, which is broadly unpopular among voters. Republican Senator Orrin Hatch disagreed. Here he is speaking after the Senate passed the bill overnight.
I have to say that this is a historic night. The Democrats have said that the American people will remember this night. I hope they do, because we passed one of the most important tax breaks in this country's history.
For more, we're joined by NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell, who is on Capitol Hill. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi there.
And the House had to vote again today because the Senate parliamentarian found three changes violated budget rules in the Senate. What exactly changed in the bill?
Sure. So the first thing that changed is they got rid of what is known as the short title. It was a kind of a technical tiny change. So that's one of them. The other one is they made changes to a provision that would have allowed families to use tax preferred savings accounts to pay for homeschooling. That was part of a broader effort by Senator Ted Cruz to expand the use of these 529 savings accounts so that it could be used for K-12 education and not just for college. But it did not fit with Senate rules for them to have that applied to homeschool as well. And there was a provision that had to do with the endowments and how for private universities and how those are taxed. So these were fairly small changes that did not do much to speak to the broader efforts of the bill. They were easily struck as part of what's known as a budget point of order, which is really just a wonky way of saying they sliced them out of the bill and moved ahead anyway.
So just some small tinkering around the edges here.
Right.
But this is, as you say, a huge bill with sweeping revisions to the tax code. Give us the broad outlines of what we're about to get in this country when it comes to taxes.
Sure. So the bill was unveiled on Friday last week, and it was a lot of things that we already knew. So they set the corporate tax rate at 21%, and that would be a permanent change. They lowered the top individual rate from 39.6 to 37% and cut tax rates across the board for most people. I think another thing that most people who are filing taxes will like to know is that their standard deduction, the thing that most people take right off the top, would nearly double to $12,000 for individuals and $24,000 for married couples. That means most people won't need to itemize, but those people who do would have access to a $10,000 cap on what's known as state and local taxes, so SALT. And they would also see the changes to the mortgage interest deduction. Any new mortgages written after the first of this year would be, their interest deduction would be capped for those over $750,000.
And there are concerns about what that might mean for the housing market. But
right.
One of the things that Republicans have been promising is that this is going to simplify the tax code, maybe that Americans could do their taxes on a postcard. That's not going to happen here.
So it's not likely that the postcard seems to have kind of slipped away from the conversation. They're saying filing on one page. That's actually kind of what some people do already with what's known as a 1040 EZ form. They are saying that it will be simpler for most people who use the standard deduction, but it's hard to make things both simple and evenly divided. So in the Senate in particular, they paid attention to having more tax rates so that they made sure that the tax burden was evenly divided across income brackets.
Now, this is a tax bill, but it's also kind of a health care bill because it gets rid of the individual mandate set up under the Affordable Care Act, which penalized people for not buying health insurance. Many people believe that Obamacare won't be able to survive without the individual mandate. What happens now that they've gotten rid of it?
Yeah, so what they did is they got rid of the penalty under the individual mandate. It's entirely possible that if Democrats were in control of the White House and in control in Congress, they could bring that back. But what it does is it means that a lot of people won't buy insurance. So the idea is that people, if they don't have to, if they aren't going to be penalized for not buying insurance, they just won't do it. And that changes the risk pools. And there's an estimate that 13 million people would lose insurance as a result of this change. A lot of that has to do with prices going up. Because if the risk pools are more difficult, if there are sicker people in the risk pools, costs go up. But there will also be a number of people who will just simply choose not to get insurance.
Kelsey, one of the big fears about this tax bill is how much it adds to the national debt, more than $1 trillion. And there is fear that Republicans will now decide to pursue changes to Medicare and other social programs. Is that likely?
Well, House Speaker Paul Ryan has said that he would like to embark on what he's calling poverty reform, which is looking at those entitlement programs that cost the government quite a good deal of money. In fact, most of the federal budget. But it would be politically difficult to do that. And it's not clear that he will have the buy-in from the Senate to do those changes next year.
That's Kelsey Snell, NPR's congressional reporter. Kelsey, thanks.
Thank you so much.
All right. That tax cut, obviously our big story of the day. We're going to keep an eye on it. But we're also going to take a look now at charter schools. An analysis by the Associated Press shows they are among the country's most segregated educational institutions. Many charter schools want that to change, but it's not necessarily the goal at one school in Nashville, Tennessee. KIPP Nashville College Prep Elementary is embracing what is a fact for many urban schools, that the student body is primarily African American. As Blake Farmer reports from member station WPLN, educators are flipping that cultural isolation into something positive.
The differences are subtle, but they're also everywhere. It's the college banners hanging in every classroom. They're all promoting historically black institutions. The murals on the walls are of smiling black children reading books while sitting on thrones. Kindergartners learn the new school song to a hip-hop track. It's all about empowerment.
All of the power is in my hands. I now can conquer the world. Pride!
We are also seeking to affirm them in their racial and cultural identities and let them know that they can be unapologetically themselves and they have the power within them. They were born with that power, which is why we refer to them as kings and queens and the royalty that is already inside of them.
Krista Thomas is the founding principal. She spent a year designing this school and recruiting teachers. She wanted kids to get an experience she didn't have until attending Spelman College in Atlanta. Until then, Thomas says she never felt like she could be herself.
I chose after high school to go to a historically black college because I felt there I could be affirmed, I could be seen, I could be loved for who I was.
Thomas's school is partially a rebuke of what's been dubbed a white savior complex. White teachers spending a couple of years teaching in a mostly black, low-income school, then moving on, often through a program known as Teach for America. Thomas herself started out with TFA and credits the organization with inspiring her to spend a career in education. But she doesn't want her students to think there's something wrong with them that needs fixing, even though many come from what are considered disadvantaged backgrounds. And she wants to have someone who looks like them at the front of every classroom.
And they see, like, I can too be a teacher because I see a black male teacher. I can be a principal. I see my black female principal walking through the hallways.
When she told me, like, the neighborhood we would be in, and she told me, a vision for having, like, an African-American school with African-American teachers, I was like, oh, I'm in. I mean, that's all I needed to know.
Jeremy Williams is one of the teachers Thomas recruited, and he's part of a highly sought-after demographic in the education world, a black male elementary school teacher. But he didn't need much convincing to work here, especially since the school is around the corner from where he grew up, and he already shared its mission.
Society will not tell African Americans how powerful they are, but KIPP Nashville College Prep Elementary is going to be that school to do so.
Beyond referring to students as royalty, the curriculum places an emphasis on black heritage.
By show of royal arm, who can tell me the setting of our story, Tales from Africa?
Williams waits for hands to go up in his first grade classroom.
Samaya.
In Africa.
In Africa. That is our setting. Now,
Kip's new elementary school in Nashville is experimental, but to be clear, it's not exclusive. Race is not a consideration for enrollment, just like at HBCUs. The school has not encountered pushback, but catering to African Americans runs counter to efforts to break up what the school district calls minority group isolation. Even decades after desegregation, many public schools in the city remain largely single race, which the district sees as a problem.
I don't know if I really subscribe to that idea that we're really as committed to diversity as we say.
Lee Williams is a historian at Tennessee State University, a historically black school. He consulted with Kip on the concept.
We have schools right here in this neighborhood that were predominantly African American 50 years ago, and they're still predominantly African American today.
But Williams says intentionally learning with black students and teachers could be a valuable experience.
I don't have problems with black folks creating spaces to deal with issues that are peculiar to them, places where they can get together and discuss strategies to deal with their existence.
After all, statistics show more than 80% of teachers are white. And even the curriculum can be biased toward white culture. Parent Latoya Morgan noticed that growing up in Chicago.
We learn about stuff in Europe, you know, and we're not from Europe. You know, there's people, ancestries from Europe and stuff, but there's a lot of things that they don't teach us in school that I think that not only just black kids, but I think all kids should know.
Morgan says she's not too worried about isolating her daughter, who's in kindergarten at Kip's New Elementary. She says, as a parent, it's her job to make sure her child has a diverse experience outside of school. For Here and Now, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
One feature of the Republican tax overhaul has very little to do with taxes. There is a provision that opens up a section of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil and gas drilling. Now, ANWR is the largest wilderness area in the United States. It's home to polar bears, millions of migratory birds, and massive herds of caribou. In 1980, a 2,300-square-mile section was set aside for future energy development, but it also required an act of Congress to authorize the drilling. The issue has divided Alaskans for the past 40 years, including indigenous people who live in the Arctic, and we're going to hear both sides of that debate now. Bernadette Dementev is a member of the Gwich'in Nation. It's a group of about 9,000. She's also executive director of the Gwich'in Steering Committee, and she's been in Washington trying to get that ANWR provision out of the tax bill. It appears she has lost that battle. Bernadette, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Were you caught by surprise that this issue was tucked into the tax bill?
I was, but we always prepare ourselves. But, you know, the Arctic Refuge deserves more recognition than to be snuck into a tax bill like this. It has absolutely nothing to do with taxes.
You've been going around Washington trying to make the case against opening ANWR up to drilling. But what have you been telling people that you've been meeting with?
Well, I've been sharing that this is a human rights violation. The Gwich'in people, since the first gathering in 1988, that was our first one in over 150 years. And we gathered because of oil and gas development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge coastal plain. Now, the coastal plain is the calving grounds of the caribou herd that we have a spiritual connection with.
Well, and just by way of background, you're talking about the porcupine caribou. There's about 200,000 in the area. In this calving ground that you referenced that is so sacred to you, it is so important that I understand your people won't even enter it. Why
yes.
is that?
As a mother myself, I understand that, you know, when you're having a child, that's a very private time. And this is an area where it's free from mosquitoes, free from predators, and they are able to gain their strength back. And they're not necessarily away from predators, but they can see them coming from a very long ways. And the caribou have been migrating and calving in this area for over 2 million years. If we push them to other areas, This is where the predators are, and there is actually nowhere else for them to calve. Mm. There's, you know, 95% of the Arctic refuge is already open to oil development, and so there's nowhere else for them to go. This remaining 5%, we are fighting very hard to keep protected.
Mm. Well, as you well know, there are other indigenous people in the Arctic that are in favor of drilling in this corner of the Arctic refuge. Matthew Rexford is the Inupiat tribal administrator of Katovic, which is the only settlement inside the refuge. And last month, he gave a statement to the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. Here he is.
We do not approve of efforts to turn our homeland into one giant national park, which literally guarantees us a fate with no economy, no jobs, reduced subsistence, and no hope for the future of our people.
What's your response to that and this argument that the mineral revenue pays for roads, it pays for schools and hospitals, and it creates jobs?
There's no amount of money that's worth losing my identity as a Gwich'in woman and mother over. You know, it's hard when we have somebody else that's indigenous that don't agree with us, but we have to follow our hearts and we have to follow what we believe in. And we believe that Creator gave us this land to honor and respect it.
Well, Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski, of course, of Alaska, who is supporting this tax bill in large part because of the provision that would open up this section of the refuge, says that Alaska will do it right. It'll take care of the land, it'll take care of the wildlife, and it will take care of the people. Do you think that there is at all a way that you can drill in a safe and responsible way there?
I personally don't believe so. You know, the developed areas that's in Alaska right now, all the caribou herds in those areas have all declined. The central herd alone has declined 57%. And there's been over 469 oil spills in the Arctic slope since 1996. So I don't believe there is a safe drilling.
Hmm. You know, the debate's been going on for almost 40 years now, ever since Jimmy Carter expanded the refuge and set aside about 1.5 million acres for possible oil and gas development. I wonder if this feels like the end to you.
This is definitely not the end. This is the beginning of a fight that we will continue to stand up against. This is our way of life. This is everything we've ever known. This is our food security. This is our spiritual connection. It's frustrating that, you know, we elected these the senators and representatives in, and then they no longer listen to our concerns or any kind of worries that we have. Alaska is thawing 3 times faster than the rest of the world right now, but our senator and our representatives are not bringing any of that up. They're not bringing up none of our coastal communities that are being forced to move. They're not bringing up our declining food security. You know, they need to start listening to their constituents, and we are saying we need help.
That's Bernadette Dementiff. She's executive director of the Gwich'in Steering Committee. She's trying to fight drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which is now a part of this tax overhaul bill. Bernadette, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And let's get the opposing view with Matthew Rexford, president of Katovic Inupiat Corporation. He's also the voice we heard earlier in that clip from the Senate committee. Matthew, welcome. And Bernadette just said that no amount of drilling money is worth losing her Gwich'in identity. What's your response to that and this divide between Native people on this issue in the Arctic?
Yes, this is a contentious issue. Folks have been debating this for over 40 years now. Our people have seen the development of Prudhoe Bay, which is 40 years old and old infrastructure compared to what is being done now with the technological advances, ensuring that these projects are done in an environmentally safe and sound manner.
You referred there to Prudhoe Bay. It's one of the biggest oil fields in North America, just west of Katovic, where you are. But to the point of the caribou, which some people believe are sacred, do you think those animals just won't be harmed by the drilling, or do you see the animals in a different way?
Well, we find the animals as sacred to us as well because we rely heavily upon the wildlife there, and we do not want to see anything harm them drastically. We understand that with the Prudhoe Bay development that has been going on, we see that the population of the caribou herds in those areas have actually increased. And so we don't see this sort of project, 2,000 acres out of 19 million acres of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, as something that will drastically impact the porcupine caribou herd.
Now, you're living in arguably the most remote place in the United States. What are the economic conditions in Katovic? It's about 240 people who live there.
Yes, that's correct. And we heavily rely on oil and gas industry and property taxes. About 95% of our regional municipal government gets their budget from the industry. Taxing the industry has created our schools in our communities, clinics, fire departments, police departments, wildlife department. It was only until the year 2000 where I got to flush a toilet in our community. And before that, we only had honey buckets. So we see sanitary benefits, and all of these benefits are thanks mostly in part due to the taxation of our borough to the oil and gas industry.
And the point should be made that people there still lead this subsistence lifestyle. They're still living off the land. They're living off the sea. But at the same time, you are open to this sort of economic development in the area. But what if the projections are wrong? The Congressional Budget Office says opening up this part of ANWR will bring in about $1 billion over the next 10 years. But, you know, there's some skepticism over that number. No one is sure exactly how much oil is out there. The economics of the industry are very different right now. I mean, is there a chance that the financial boost has been overestimated?
I don't believe so. With the resources that are in the area, I think it may be even more than that $1 billion mark.
Really? Why?
Because of how much is actually in that area. And what we are looking to do is to explore the area. So you can't get a good picture of what's there until you open it for exploration.
As you know, Alaska's congressional delegation has been trying to figure out a way to open up this part of the country for drilling for a very long time now. Did you ever think this day was coming?
I've seen it. I lived with it. And we did not foresee this coming since the last time it got vetoed by President Clinton.
All right, that's Matthew Rexford, president of the Katovic Inupiat Corporation up there in the Arctic Circle, in favor of a provision in this tax bill that would open up part of the Arctic Wildlife Refuge to drilling. Matthew, thank you very much for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
The man who led the Archdiocese of Boston during a clergy sex abuse scandal that shook the foundation of the Catholic Church around the world has died. Cardinal Bernard Law was 86 and living in Rome. He resigned as Archbishop in 2002 after the abuse scandal was uncovered by investigative reporters at the Boston Globe. Joining us now is John Allen, editor of Crux. He's on Skype from Rome. John, welcome.
Hello, Peter.
So, you know, the sex abuse scandal spanned decades and involved hundreds of priests, more than 700 children. Just remind us what Cardinal Law's connection was.
Well, Cardinal Law became the public symbol of the clerical sexual abuse scandals. What we saw in Boston was a pattern in which church authorities, up to and including Cardinal Law, were made aware of credible allegations of sexual abuse against these priests, but simply moved them from assignment to assignment in an attempt to disguise the behavior rather than reporting it to civil authorities, allowing the criminal justice process to play out, and the church taking its lumps. And so, in a sense, Cardinal Law became the highly public example of what not to do. And virtually everything the Catholic Church has done in the decades since could be understood in a way as an attempt to undo the law legacy.
As this was happening and as he resigned in 2002, what was his demeanor? Did he take responsibility?
Well, ultimately, Cardinal Law took responsibility and admitted guilt and apologized for it. But early on, when it was the most crucial, Law often came off as defensive, as unapologetic, and more concerned with protecting the welfare of the institution than he was with the welfare of victims and survivors of clerical abuse.
After the fallout, he's reassigned. He goes to Rome. And that was a pretty controversial move in and of itself. I just wonder how the final years of his life played out.
Well, you know, that move to Rome, I think, was always misunderstood in the United States. When he was named the Archpriest of St. Mary Major, which is one of the four pontifical basilicas here, papal basilicas, it was seen as some kind of honor. But, you know, in Rome, it was the exact opposite. I mean, in Rome, the understanding is that if you are the cardinal of one of the most powerful dioceses in the world, which Bernie Law was in Boston, and then you become the archpriest of a Roman basilica, where basically your responsibilities are to ensure that the lights are turned on for Mass on Sunday. I mean, that is seen as a disgrace. That's where careers go to die.
So I'm sure you'd agree there's a lot more to this man than the scandal, but it is unfortunately for his legacy how he'll be remembered. The Archdiocese in Boston paid out $85 million to the victims. From your perspective there in Rome, has the church recovered from all this?
No. Recovery is a work in progress. And I think the thing to worry about with the death of Cardinal Bernard Law is that some may be tempted to think, well, now that he is dead, the story is basically over. I'm telling you, the story is not over. There is a great deal of unfinished business. The Catholic Church has not recovered. It is still recovering and still has some ground to cover.
And for the hundreds of victims out there, you know, it may never be over for them. John Allen, editor of Crux in Rome, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Peter.
China, the world's biggest greenhouse gas emitter, has just launched the world's largest carbon trading market. Joining us from Shanghai is NPR correspondent Rob Schmitz. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Jeremy.
And once this goes into effect, it'll be the largest carbon trading scheme on the planet. Give us an idea of how big an impact it'll have.
Well, this is China, so size and scale are usually off the charts, and this is no exception. Just to give you an idea of the size of this new carbon market, it's going to be 1.5 times as large as the world's current largest carbon market, which is in the EU, and several times bigger than California's market, which is the largest in North America. And it's going to cover 3 billion tons of carbon dioxide emissions per year. So that's a tenth of all carbon emissions worldwide, and it will do so by forcing nearly 2,000 coal and natural gas power companies, that's a third of all power companies in China, to buy carbon credits from less polluting companies. And of course, that imposes a financial incentive on everyone to burn less carbon.
And it also will make China into, undoubtedly, the world's leader on climate change in a way.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, and a lot of this has to do with the United States stepping down from its leadership position on this issue. As we know, President Trump has consistently cast doubt on whether humans cause climate change. He's appointed a man who agrees with this view to head the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. And late last June, Trump announced he would remove the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord. So that leaves a pretty big leadership vacuum globally. And it's only natural that China is now starting to fill it. China's leaders have traditionally been made up of engineers. Many of them have a background in the sciences. And across the board, they all agree that humans do cause climate change. They've seen it firsthand here on the ground in China. No other country emits as much carbon as China does. And nowhere on Earth can you see the environmental damage that humans cause as you can here in China.
Do China's leaders face any pushback when they make a decision like this on a carbon trading market?
You know, they don't, because I think that most Chinese people consider the leadership realm a realm that they really don't belong in. And, you know, I think in many ways that's largely because when they do something like this, they usually do it right. The plan here is to conduct a 3-year test period before implementing the carbon transactions. And there are some, you know, there are some questions out there as to whether China can pull this off. But if China's domestic environmental policies in the last year are any guide, then yes, we can expect full implementation on this. You know, in the past year, China's Ministry of Environment has waged a national campaign to reduce pollution. Inspection teams have closed tens of thousands of factories. You know, this has had a big impact on the air quality in the big eastern cities like Beijing and here in Shanghai. And so what's becoming clear to China's leadership is that pollution and issues like climate change are important to urban Chinese, so important that the leadership feels they're being judged by their citizens on how well they protect the environment.
What's the smog there like today where you are?
Well, you know, this is the big pollution season, so it's typically terrible this time of year. The air quality index is currently a little under 200, which is around twice as high as what the World Health Organization considers unsafe. So, yeah, not great, but better than previous years, I would say. And still, you know, my air filters are on here in my house.
And are authorities making the case that with this new carbon trade-in market that the smog will be a little better?
Well, I think they are telling people to wait and see. You know, these things don't happen overnight.
Right.
And, you know, and of course, with a country as large as China, I think that leaders generally don't promise too much because things generally tend to take a little time to change. But they are sort of guiding the future. You know, China does tend to change and sort of guide its change in 5-10-year plans. So it's quite different from the U.S.
One more thing, Rob. We're talking to you on a day when the Congress here in the U.S. is passing its tax cut package, which is going to add, by a lot of the analysts' estimates, $1.5 trillion to U.S. debt. China owns a lot of that debt. How are Chinese people feeling about this today?
You know, well, you're right. The Chinese do own a significant percentage of U.S. debt. But keep in mind here that, you know, the reason that China buys U.S. treasuries is to keep its own currency pegged to the dollar, which in turn, you know, sort of keeps the Chinese currency artificially low so that exports from China to the U.S. remain pretty cheap. So more U.S. debt might mean more opportunity for the Chinese to keep doing this and to keep exporting more affordable products to the U.S. and elsewhere.
That's NPR's Rob Schmitz in Shanghai. Rob, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Florida's Everglades are known for their alligators, but now another reptile is king, the invasive Burmese python. A group of veterans who call themselves the Swamp Apes have found that hunting these snakes can help the environment while also treating their combat-induced PTSD. Maria Bacalapolo has the story from the Everglades.
Rolling, 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 get those pythons rolling.
Meet Thomas Rahill, founder of the Swamp Apes.
Pythoning is nothing like you'd expect it to be, but it's everything you'd hope for.
Rahill and other members of this nonprofit are on a nighttime drive in search of big, dark shadows slithering across the road.
When you come across a really big python, I don't care where you are, it's extreme. They're an amazing animal, very dangerous animal. You have to know what you're doing.
The Swamp Apes are a group of mostly military veterans. The program gives the vets a chance to use their combat training to help conserve the Everglades ecology.
The point of this is to get veterans the opportunity to transition into a civilian society and celebrate their military service and appreciate their military service.
The Burmese python was first sighted in the Everglades in the 1980s, released by irresponsible pet owners, and now numbers are estimated in the tens of thousands. It is devastating the native wildlife in one of America's unique ecosystems. Sergeant Major Tom Acock serves in the Army Active Guard Reserve in Homestead, Florida. As a Swamp Apes mentor, he helps the men as they dig out a hole in the side of a levee in search of a python nest.
It's a distinctive feel when you hit that. And we know what they feel like from holding them so much.
After 20 minutes, he concludes the snake has escaped into a deeper, inaccessible part of the levee. The men are unfazed and move on.
The military teaches you endurance, and it teaches you patience. And a lot of times, you know, being out here looking for these snakes, each time 6-7 hours looking for these things, and they're not evolving, you have to find a way to dig down deep and say, you know, this is the mission.
One of the members of the Swamp Apes is Joe Medina. He joined the Navy right after high school in 2000, as he says, for all the right reasons, to serve his country. He wanted to have an adventurous life, but when he left the service after 5 years and returned to society, he felt alienated.
Oftentimes I have difficulty sleeping. I'm constantly alert. I'm oftentimes hypervigilant. I started thinking about the war more. Things started showing up more.
After his service, Medina started working at a VA hospital, but found it triggered his PTSD. He doesn't like to talk about it, but knew he needed something to channel his energy.
Well, I really don't want to get into, like, you know, dead bodies and killing people. But I will say that hunting for pythons definitely helps. At least I have something to look for and, you know, kill.
Here we go. Right underneath me.
Got him?
Yep.
Finally, after 12 hours of looking, the crew finds a huge python, its head twisting and biting as they stretch it out and haul it up the road. It turns out to be 15 feet long.
He's an animal!
That is the adrenaline rush Joe Medina was looking for.
There was no words that could describe the feelings that I had. It was unbelievable to see such a large predator that did not belong in my environment.
The Swamp Apes have set their sights on cementing the value of wilderness programs in PTSD therapy and expanding the model to other parts of America. And just this fall, researchers from the University of South Florida touted the benefits of the program to the American Public Health Association. For Here and Now, I'm Maria Bacalopoulo.
And Maria's story comes to us from the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans.
With major changes coming to the tax code, the Internal Revenue Service has a very big job ahead of it. It's got to figure out how to put those changes into place and how to explain them to millions of Americans filing tax returns. And for the past few years, the IRS has already been struggling to keep up with its current workload after huge cuts to its budget and to its staff. Joining us now on Skype is former IRS Commissioner John Koskinen. He was nominated by President Obama in 2013, and just last month, on November 12th to be exact, he retired. John, welcome.
I'm delighted to be here.
What's the state of the agency that is now responsible for carrying out this tax law?
Well, it's got a wonderful workforce dedicated to the mission of the agency, but it is significantly constrained by a lack of resources. The budget is $900 million below where it was in 2010, even though we've got 10 million more taxpayers and a lot of work to do.
So, all right, what does that mean? Best case scenario, if everything goes smoothly and you've got an agency that's endured $900 million of cuts over the last several years, how big is the job ahead?
Well, even without the cuts, the job would be very big. It's obviously the biggest tax overhaul in 30 years. But when you've lost over 21,000 employees, it means that the challenge is much more difficult and significant.
How so? If I am an American taxpayer and I want to get in touch with the IRS because I have a question, and you can bet there's going to be a lot of questions out there in the coming months, what can the public expect when they try to interact with the agency?
Well, they can expect the employees are going to try very hard to give the best service they can. But with proposed cuts in the House and Senate yet on top of the $900 million, I think taxpayers are going to have to expect it's going to take longer than anyone would like for them to get a hold of somebody on the phone.
You've used pretty dire language in your description of what you could see coming. You have said that it's possible that the IRS could collapse. Do you really believe that?
I really do. I talked to a number of congressmen and senators before I left saying that this is a real challenge and a real problem, that you can't keep cutting the budget of the agency without either threatening the ability of its information technology to process the filing season or without over time threatening the compliance rate of the public. A 1% decline in the compliance rate costs the government $33 billion a year.
Hmm. How did the IRS handle the 1986 tax overhaul?
Well, there were a couple of things going for the agency and the public then. And first, it was over 2 years of consideration, so people had a longer time to prepare for what the bill was going to look like. The IRS was better funded to begin with, and my understanding is the Congress provided additional funding in recognition of the fact that the tax reform then was going to require a lot of work. There's been no indication yet that the Congress is prepared to provide more funding for the IRS now, but it's critical for the agency and for the taxpayers.
Well, I mean, and you know as well as anyone probably that Republicans have used the IRS as a punching bag over the years. They've threatened to abolish it. They've accused it of being political. They've even threatened over the years to impeach you. But in this law, the language is pretty clear that lawmakers are delegating the execution of the bill to an agency that they seem to distrust. Does that concern you?
Well, it is a recognition on the part of the Congress that ultimately, when push comes to shove, they have confidence the agency can do the work. The agency continues to get new programs, new credit programs. It's a major and a poverty agency now, providing over $100 billion in refundable credits across the board. So it is an irony that on the one hand, you have the majority in Congress attacking the IRS, and on the other hand, you have them relying upon the IRS to implement everything, including this new tax bill.
You retired just about a month ago, as we've said. So, I mean, how involved was the agency as Congress moved forward with drafting it?
Well, it was a major difference from the Reagan tax reform in 1986. At that time, what you had was the representatives of the Congress and the administration debating tax policy that should be included in the bill, and the IRS at the table, not with an issue in the policy side, but basically helping draft the bill to make sure that it was understandable by taxpayers and administratable. This time around, while we made it very clear that we had no dog in the fight about the policy, I continued to encourage the tax writers and the administration to draw upon the expertise of the dedicated employees at the IRS. And as a general matter, that didn't happen.
Now, one more question I want to ask you. Republicans have promised that it would simplify the filing process. The president even said, you know, you could file your taxes on the back of a postcard. What do you think? Will this law make it easier for Americans to do their taxes?
Well, for a significant number of Americans who take the standard deduction, which now has been doubled, the filing of their return will be better. There were 60% of people didn't itemize before. The estimate is that about 90% of taxpayers now will not itemize. They'll, in effect, file a straightforward, what we call a 1040EZ is the name of the form. And it's not quite a postcard, or you might view it as a big postcard, but it's straightforward and relatively simple. So for about 30% of the taxpayers, this will be an improvement.
That's John Koskinen, former IRS commissioner, recently retired about a month ago. John, thank you very much for your perspective on this.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been my pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.